Welcome to the E-Commerce Momentum Podcast, where we focus on the people, the products, and the process of e-commerce selling today. Here's your host, Stephen Peterson.
Welcome back to the E-Commerce Momentum Podcast. This is episode 90, Orr Benzaby. You probably have no clue who Orr is, unless you're from the West Coast. And if you do, you're probably not happy I'm talking about him because he's like your best kept secret. The dude is great. I'm going to say it that way. He is a great guy, smart as a whip, quiet, a little subdued, but listening, paying attention, and then comes out with stuff and you're like, oh my God, this guy really knows what he's doing. Just a smart, smart young guy who kind of grew into the business at the same time as his father kind of grew into the business. And it's really interesting how close they are. And man, I admire that, you know, having that confidant that you can talk to in that kind of relationship is just incredible. And you just know why he's knocking it out of the park. Let's get into the podcast. All right, welcome back to the E-Commerce Momentum Podcast. And tonight's guest, I am so excited because this dude knows his stuff. Very quiet, very subdued, but always studying, always listening. He just fit right in with our crazy crowd the second we met him. Now, when I met him, he was just on his way back from Vegas, and that story should get told. I think we should tell that story. Welcome, Orr Benzaby. Did I get the last name right?
Yeah, you got it well.
Orr, man, we had such a great time in Orlando. You, me, Andy Slam. It was a ball, wasn't it?
It was just so much fun. It was a lot of fun.
Now, you were just coming off of a trip to Vegas, right? You just got back.
Your
voice was dead.
Was
you had no
good.
Voice. We didn't add to it with our escapades.
No, that did not help in the slightest.
So what were you in Vegas for?
My friends and I do an annual trip for March Madness. And so I literally went to Vegas Thursday, flew out of Vegas Sunday straight to Orlando with no voice and just kind of hoped for the best. From there.
And you, I'm sure there were some adult beverages and some fun late nights. Is it get wilder as the years go on, or is it getting more subdued as they start to get married off?
It's definitely more subdued, but my friends enjoy their adult beverages, so it was still a good time.
And in Vegas, I mean, it's all the time, right? I mean, it just doesn't stop.
No, not in the slightest.
Although we did some pretty late nights in Orlando for the old man kept up one night. I couldn't keep up the second night. You guys outpaced me. I just couldn't keep up.
It was I don't know what was harder there, the Orlando trip or Vegas. I mean, what was for sure the most difficult was going to a CrossFit workout at 7 o'clock in the morning after going out till 3 in Orlando. Yeah. That was not the smartest move I've ever made.
And what was my comment? No chance I'm getting up. All right, so let's talk about why you were in Orlando. Why did you, who's a really successful seller, who's killing it, why did you decide to go to the ScanPower conference?
Well, I mean, it's you're always learning. So I knew Chris reached out to me. I met Chris a while ago, and he reached out saying, It's big sellers. I'd really enjoy the people there. And he was, I mean, like Chris always is, he was 100% correct. So I went out there and just had a blast, learned a ton, met awesome people. And that was kind of exactly what I was hoping for.
Oh, that's great. So you really did get what you were looking for out of there. I mean, it's not like you go back and you got the one tip to enhance your business, but a lot of it is reinforcing what you're doing, right? Maybe fine-tuning a little bit, right? At that point you're at in your business, it's not going to take a miracle change to move you off, you know? I mean, you've got a direction, and so you're just continually sharpening. Is that a good way to say it?
Yeah, because, I mean, my scale, it's not like I can turn the business on a dime anyways. If I wanted to do a shift, it would be a lot of time, a lot of effort. It would not be something that, you know, I can just now go to the store and add a couple of products.
Okay, because I do want to talk about that, because when you are that large, what happens, right, when there is a big functional shift, either in Amazon or, you know, West Coast shipping shuts down. So we'll talk about that in a second. But first, I want to go back because you come from an entrepreneurial family.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, is that all you know? Thinking back, Let me ask you this. Were your grandparents entrepreneurial?
Yeah. So, I mean, even if you want to go broader than that. So I was born in Israel, came to the U.S. When I was really young, like 2 years old. And almost every single family friend that I grew up around is an entrepreneur. And they range from, you know, the solo accountant all the way up to people running $100 million a year manufacturing companies. And so it was just kind of what I was always around. It was what I always wanted. And I mean, I knew I was going to have my own business since I was just as young as can be.
I mean, is that the way you're developed? I mean, because you're in that environment, right? Even with schooling, is that the way it's developed? It's like, all right, here's the best suggestion for you to take because this is going to benefit you later on. Is that kind of the way it is?
Yeah. I mean, if we're talking schooling, I applied to one school because it had a great entrepreneurship program and I knew I was going to get into the school.
I mean, was that pushed by your parents? I mean, were they guiding you that way or?
Oh, no. You know, my parents were, in that sense, completely hands off. They've never been, as long as I did well, or as long as they knew I was putting forth effort, that was what mattered to them, because there's classes you can get A's in without trying. So as long as they felt like I was putting forth a good effort, they didn't care what direction I took.
And both your parents are entrepreneurs, or your dad was?
Both of my parents, depends on how you think about it, being an entrepreneur. My mom's mm-hmm. more of the small business owner type, where she just has the one kind of business that she's done for, and 20, 25 years now. And it's just a good little mom and pop type company. And then my dad's the one that's...
Well, is it retail?
No, it's a daycare center.
Okay. All right. But it's hers. And so she's been running it, and that's, you know, employees facing all those issues.
Yep. I mean, she started it. We came to the U.S. 3 days later, she had a company up and running.
Well, I mean, so even in Israel, is that the way their culture was there too?
Yeah, per capita, actually, Israel is the highest density of entrepreneurs in the world.
Hmm. Yeah. Very interesting. I mean, you sit back and you think about when you grow up in that environment, I mean, all you're doing is every decision is made to help sharpen that, right? You're always enhancing. You see somebody's good idea and you come up with a little way to improve it or whatever. It just gets better and better and better. So, Okay, so as they come here, I'm sorry, my mind just trailed off because it's just to see that environment for those of us who've never been in it. I've never had an entrepreneur in my family. Mm-hmm. So it's so different. Everything is a challenge, right? Because everything's new to me. You, not that you take it for granted, but it's just natural to you. So that's the difference. It's really interesting to note that. So they come here and she starts a business. And what's your dad do?
My dad worked three jobs. So that was right off the bat.
To help pay for everything.
Yeah, because starting a business, there's very few people that can start a business and overnight with zero contacts, zero. I mean, they knew nobody here. They didn't have anything, zero money, and start a company instantly. It's profitable, right? That doesn't happen that often. And so he was working three jobs, going to school, and eventually kind of figure out his own way.
That work ethic. That also had to rub pretty far deep into you, and I know it does because that's why you're having so much success. But that's got to be a pretty cool thing to look back on. You know, I mean, think of how hard he struggled to make it. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, it makes it impossible to complain knowing that, you know, I had somebody in my family that was doing three jobs and just then coming home and taking care of the family and helping my mom with her business on top of it. And then my mom had her business the full time. There's no, you know, there's no light hour entrepreneur. And so, yeah, there's no complaining. There's no whining about how many hours I'm working or anything like that.
It probably doesn't go far at a dinner time, right? That conversation, come on, suck it up. You don't realize what I had to do.
No.
Is he becoming that guy? Is he becoming that quote in the old stuff? I used to work three jobs.
No, I think I was able to prove myself early on that if I've got my head on something, I'll outwork just about anybody.
That's interesting.
Yeah, and so he never gave me that, especially because I've been reasonably successful. So I think he's just kind of proud of me, I hope.
Well, I know he is, and because of the conversation, which we'll get to in a second. But your dad started a business. Talk about that.
Which one?
Well, the one that didn't succeed.
Okay. So he had a slew of companies, and then at one point he went the true startup route.
Well, and were the other companies successful? He had some success?
To varying degrees. I mean, they were enough to pay the bills always, but it was never like he sold the company and we were flush as a family.
Okay.
And so they were mainly small businesses, and you grow up in that environment, you see the different difficulties that every kind of business has. So whether it's a partnership issue or the economy falls or something. I mean, there's always a million things that can possibly go wrong.
Well, and in a culture, there are a lot of partnerships, right? I mean, that's just natural.
Yeah, and I think it's also just natural in the business culture. I mean, most people don't start a company on their own.
Okay. And so something didn't work out or what have you. And did that bring him down completely?
So for the one, the big one, that was the startup, he had three friends that they had been working together for 10 years, and they're still great friends, but it was just it was a cool product at the wrong time.
Okay.
And when the company went under in 08 during the crash, it was definitely difficult, and on top of that, he had, you know, an IRS audit and a bunch of other things, and it made life really difficult. And you see just a level of resiliency that certain entrepreneurs have or just certain people have. And it's impressive. I don't know how he was able to handle that kind of stress on a day-to-day level.
Yeah, and you were a teenager watching this. I mean, so that had to be really difficult watching your father go through, especially somebody who you worship. I mean, let's face it. And to see him struggle in that way. Did he bring it home with him, or was he able to put the iron curtain on when he came home and then just took it off when he went back out into the world?
It's all a bit of it depends, right? Like, you know, the guy's not going to complain. The guy's not going to show too much, but you can see the stress wearing on him. And if you know someone well enough, you can always kind of tell how they're doing. And so that was something that even if he didn't want to bring it home, you kind of just see it.
Well, what would you take away from that now? So you were a young teenager watching that, and so you saw that. What are some of the – I mean, obviously the perseverance is a big thing, but what else would you say is the thing that brought him through that maybe could be transferred to others, that others could get something from?
I mean, I think the big thing is just the resourcefulness, right? There wasn't the cash coming in. There was all these extra stresses, and that's when he kind of – he discovered selling books on Amazon. and so he just started hustling that and got that to a reasonably good-sized little income. I mean, it was definitely a full-time income.
Well, wait, where was he getting his books? I mean, was he doing the book sale thing and, you know, buying them wherever he could, yard sales and everything?
So in California, the advantage is every library – I haven't been, so maybe they don't have any more, but every library had a bookstore attached to it. And so this was still fairly new. I mean, you're talking about 8 years ago.
All right. 2008, yeah, the FBA just getting started pretty much.
Yeah. And so he was going to all the library bookstores and buying books during the summers when I was coming home from school. I would help him out, and then, I mean, we weren't even comfortable doing FBA at the beginning. And so for the first year and a half, we just had one of the old bedrooms that I moved out of, took out everything, put in shelves, and we just had, I can't tell you how many books in there that we were shipping every night.
Thousands and thousands.
Yeah.
I mean, just books. And so, but, you know, that's a great foundation for eventually what would come, because I think once you get that appreciated, it's interesting with people who only done FBA, they start to wonder about merchant fulfilled. Is it really that big of a deal? Is it worth doing? And if you've done enough of it for a while, you'll understand.
Oh,
FBA
yeah.
is incredible.
you couldn't pay me to start doing merchant fulfilled anymore.
All right, so there is an eagle rising from the ashes here. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, I want to hear about his success, which ultimately leads to your success. We'll take a quick break. We'll be right back. Hope you're having a great 2016. We know we are. It is a great year. Second quarter, looking pretty strong. We're in shoes and clothing. We think you should be too. If you are thinking about it, look at yoursourcedinventory.com. That's yoursourcedinventory.com. We're members. Listen to these stats. March, average shoe rank 7,290 with a selling price of $89.42. Now think about that. That high selling price is where you're going to benefit. $31.40 profit, 80% return of investment. That's incredible. Clothing, average clothing rank was 8,966. Average selling price, $46.06. Again, you don't have to sell as many items to get that profit. Average profit, $16.99. Almost $17. That is a great deal. 94% return of investment. That's yoursourcedinventory.com. Think about getting that clothing list, that shoe list sent to you 5 days a week, once a day. Take advantage. You'll grow your business as much as we have. Yoursourcedinventory.com. Thanks. I told you this guy's smart. You know, in this segment, we spend a lot of time talking about business. Now, OR does have a prep center in the California in the West Coast. So if you've been thinking about using a prep center, I mean, he's got some minimum requirements and, you know, he does volumes, but, you know, he's a pallet shipper. That's a great way to go. When he tells you his cost for shipping, you'll cry. I think he actually said it at one point to ship to some of the California warehouses, he's spending 7 cents a pound. Where I'm located on the East Coast, it's 90 to a dollar to send to that same warehouse. You want to talk about a competitive advantage. Well, when you tackle on his fees, you might be at a break even and never touch the product. That's a pretty good system. Great guy, real knowledgeable. And I just think he's got so much to offer, and he's just been so quiet on the sidelines, but I don't think he'll be quiet anymore. Just a great guy. Let's get back into the podcast. All right, we're back, and we're talking with OR Benzavi. I get it again?
Yeah.
I try it, man. That's a tough one. It's a it's not easy to do and do it justice because it's a proud name. So your dad was rising up from a pretty significant letdown. How does that emotionally affect his perseverance? Is he now even more steadfast in what he knows because he's been to the bottom but came out of it and rose above it? Do you see that in him?
Well, for him, one thing that he always taught me was the need to be flexible. You never know what's going to happen. You never know how it's going to hit you. And he's a serial entrepreneur. So, from just off of my memory, I think this is the sixth or seventh company I've seen him be a part of.
Okay, so this is roll off, get it started, get it going. That's a California culture. I mean, it really is, where you see these people just start business after business. I'll get it right, I'll get it right, I'll get it right. And eventually they do get it right.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting. Okay, so he now is selling books, you're helping him. And what happens? How does he get into his line of business? And I'm not going to say a specific line, I know it, but I don't want to say it. How does he get into that?
Eventually, so my dad has a separate Amazon company today.
Okay.
And eventually he actually discovered Chris Green's book. And by this time I'd finished undergrad, moved to Chicago, and he was doing it for like 6 months or so. And I came home for Thanksgiving and he just kind of gave me the book because I wanted to do the, at the same time, he was still doing a lot of book selling.
Okay.
And so he gives me retail arbitrage because I wanted to do the same thing in Chicago, but I couldn't find a good source to purchase books. And that kind of just opened my eyes. And for the next couple of years, both of us were just doing two separate businesses, always been that way, and we were just both doing RA. And you learn a lot of things because when you're in a retail business, the amount of cash needed to grow is incredible.
Well, say that again. So when you're in a retail business, so meaning when you're doing retail ARP, or do you mean when you're selling, Legos at a toy store? Which do you mean? Or both?
Any kind of physical goods business. You can be a wholesaler, you can be a retailer, but you're selling physical products. And if you have to pay for the product ahead of time to grow the business from, say, a $10,000 a month to a $100,000 a month operations, you need to have that growth in inventory. And so you need the cash on hand to be able to purchase those larger and larger quantities.
Mm.
And, I mean, if you want to do $100,000 in sales, if you're using Chris's, one-third, one-third, and one-third spectrum, you need to have $30,000 every month worth of inventory that's selling.
Right. And it's not magically you don't get it at day one. It's all month long. So you're turning and turning and turning to get to that magic number. So it's probably even more than that because it's not like you're selling
yep.
100% of your inventory, right? So it's even more than that to really get to that level and stay at that level.
Exactly. And so if you're growing a retail business, the amount of cash to do so is really, if you're just some independent person that's coming in with just the funds in your pocket, it's a lot of cash.
Mm. Is it possible, though, for somebody to come in with, $500 in their pocket and get to that $100,000 level?
I mean, I came in with a Capital $1,000 credit card.
Okay. So the answer is yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know,
you're a mega seller by any stretch, and everybody hates when I say that term because they never can figure out what it means. But tough. I don't care. You know, it's true though. But you've scaled to an enormous level. Do you think it was your father's, you know, watching your father scale? I mean, was it competition between the two of you?
It's friendly competition, more probably on my end, because my dad doesn't care about my sales.
Right. He's like, come on, boy, you could do better than this. Come on, man.
Yeah. I'm very competitive, so for me it was always I wanted to catch up to him, and he had a few years head start on it, not to mention more cash to begin with. So from my end it was, but we took very different growth strategies.
Okay, so let's talk about it. So he has this second Amazon business. He's still doing his little merchant fulfilled thing. He finds a category. I mean, how does he get into that category?
So
it's just unusual. It's not like, you know, it's just different than, you know, let's just say he's a toy seller. You know, he's not selling Star Wars toys or what have you. I mean, I understand he probably did some of that stuff. But how does he choose that? I mean, because it's almost like he figured out something that he's meant to be. Was it a culmination? That's where I'm trying to get to, is that trying to help people, you know, everything sells, right?
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that you're really good at selling everything. And so I'm trying to figure out how to help people get to what – to figure out, you know, the culmination of that pushes you to where you are today.
Right.
Do you get what I mean?
Yeah. And, you know, I've had this conversation in different degrees with a lot of people recently. Mm. And I think some of the way that people are thinking about it is kind of – it's not like we sat down and wrote a business plan. But what does happen, and I went one model, he went with a different one. We're both, you know, pretty significant sellers at this point. But it was – one of it is you fall into it. But one thing you realize is at scale, you need a competitive advantage. And so his thing is a lot of bundling, and he discovered a very good way to create bundles and multi-packs, and that was where he really kind of started making good money, and that's where his business scaled. And when you think about your Amazon business, most people that are doing, say, RA, it's they may not be thinking about their competitive advantage, but there is a very distinct one in that it's you're buying low volumes typically. With a huge number of SKUs relatively to most other retail companies, and you are actually banking on the fact that you are going to sell your inventory faster. And that's how most of the retail companies are, or the retail ARB companies are built around, but they just don't think about it in that sense. They just see these magical numbers that, you know, they're making them money. But it's a huge competitive advantage. And that's why you have sellers that really figure that space out and realize that they can buy, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of inventory every year just doing RA and turn that into a monster business. But they just have to have their own model and kind of their rules to scale.
It is absolutely scalable, even for retail, if you bring in the right help, right? I mean, as you're saying, you're buying 1 to 3 to 5 to 10 of an item. I always like David Hawkins. He's always like, Steve, you chase the product, right? So he finds 2 or 3 hot products at Target's. Okay, now there's 23 targets.
Yep.
Go get, you know, 2 or 3 at every single one of them. Now you've got scale, right? That's how you get to that scale level. And as you're saying, it takes a lot of cash, but it takes a lot of smart and a lot of – it's exhausting.
Yep.
I mean, that part is exhausting. How long did you do RA heavy?
2 to 2.5 years, I would say.
And what made you get out of it?
Too many hours.
Too many hours. It's exhausting, right? I mean, it really is.
Yeah.
I when I look at like a David Hawkins, David and his wife Ivy, you know, they make a, you know, lifestyle out of it. You know, they really have, you know, but he's brought in help. I mean, he's not, he will tell you that he's brought in help to help handle some of the volume because it's just gotten to so large. But they still love it. And I think that that's what's so cool is that they've made a lifestyle out of it.
Mm-hmm.
When you're doing it by yourself, I think it's very challenging. You know, it gets tiring. It gets boring. It gets old, you know, just driving around by yourself at some point, right?
Oh, yeah, it's exhausting. I mean, I would have days where, especially during the holidays, I was doing, you know, 20 hours a day. And you're just sitting in the car going into the same store for what feels like the 800th time that day. And the layout's the same. The products you're looking for the same. The conversations you have with other people there are the same. And you know it's going to be the same thing tomorrow. It was the same thing yesterday. And I'd just be sitting there going, okay, just get out of the car. Just get out and do it one more time. Like, you have to psych myself up to do that. And there are people that do love RA. For me, it's one of those things where if you were to ask me to do it today, I'd probably just quit.
That's Andy Slammons. He's like, after an hour, he's like, all right, Steve, I'm tired. Let's go. Let's go do something else. I'm bored.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what was the trigger that made you transition to wholesale? I mean, was it your move back to California, or were you still in Ohio?
So I was in Chicago and moved to California.
Or Chicago, Illinois. Duh.
And I started really small with wholesale, right? Like I said, there wasn't some grand plan with me mapping out the steps, because you never know. I mean, the way my business model shifted into what it shifted, it wouldn't have worked. Like, when I first started, it was heavy on toys. It was still a good opportunity in toys to make really great margins. And as competition comes in, you kind of find your specialty. And I found mine, which was really heavy, breakable products. And most people just don't want to deal with it. And so eventually I kind of shifted into that space and became kind of a bigger player there. But getting out of wholesale, it took me almost a year, year and a half, I would say, where basically I just scaled the wholesale stuff until the point where I realized, okay, I can spend all of my monthly inventory allocation just on wholesale and still be hitting the numbers that I'm trying to hit.
So what do you say, though, and I think the answer, I think you've already said the answer, what do you say to those who say that wholesale's return of investment isn't as high, it's not as fast, it's slow, you know, you can't, it's not quick money? And that's probably true if you're selling Star Wars dolls, right, or Elsa dolls, right, because everybody can get those. And, again, there's no competitive advantage other than price, pretty much, right?
Yeah.
You had kind of mentioned your little, secret sauce is that you're willing to do heavy, breakable items, where that's a big barrier to entry for almost everybody else who isn't ready to scale.
Mm-hmm.
with employees and warehousing and all that kind of stuff. Would you say that If you were going out to do it again, knowing what you know, do you think you could replicate that, not doing heavy breakable things, but are there isolated niches within wholesale that somebody can take advantage of, and how do they help figure that out, I guess is where I'm going.
I mean, I would say you can do that with any sphere that you're going for. It's just, look, I would generally agree that wholesale is not as fast as retail. And it's, in my opinion, it's more competitive, because you're now working against people who, instead of being, you know, looking for 100% ROI, are okay with 30. And you have to kind of figure out how do you compete with those people, especially when, I mean, there's people out there that have $1 million bank accounts and are just coming in and spending, you know, several million a year on inventory. And so if you want to compete with that, you better really know the space. And I think wholesale takes longer to learn. It's a little more complicated. It's almost impossible, in my opinion, to do it at scale without employees. But I think it's something that you can definitely get into. I think it's something you can definitely learn. And if I wanted to completely shift my wholesale model, I can think of 3 or 4 directions to take it and still get to a pretty good scale relatively quickly.
Would you say that those who are out there, if they're struggling in retail, they really ought to take a dip into wholesale to see if that would be a better fit for them? Because I think those who love retail arb, who just love it, you know, Goose, people like that who just thrive on it, that's their thing. But they're hard to find. You know, there's a lot of people that are struggling. How do you get past that, right? So is it a dip in wholesale the way to go for some people?
It could be.
Doesn't have to be.
No. And my thing is, whenever people ask me about what they should do, because normally when someone starts something, the moment they get hard, it gets hard, they start to think about what other opportunities they could do that sound better. And in my experience, you really need to be able to figure out the niche that you're currently in and then move on to the next one.
So master it.
Yeah, master it, or just get it to the point where it's working. And then shift. Because if you're just doing the same thing and you're constantly kind of getting to the point where you're struggling, giving up and going to the next one, the grass is always going to be greener somewhere else.
Well, the shiny object syndrome doesn't help, right?
No.
You're not a big Facebook guy, right?
No, I almost never post.
Right, and so does that help you keep focused, do you think?
To an extent. With the business, what I've done is I really try to narrow my options. And whenever I have too many opportunities, that's when I'm like, okay, I need to remove stuff. Because if I'm thinking I can do X, Y, and Z, and I only have so much time in the day, I know I'm going to screw them all up. And so I try to, like when I scaled my retail business, the retail ARB, it was I set very strict rules on categories, on rank, and on ROI. And that's when my business blew up, because all the extra stuff that I could be spending the money on that might work, might not work, was just thrown aside.
And when how do you walk past that, right? So you know, that's a good example, right? So you're in Target and you're buying, I don't know, you're buying Legos because that's what you're into, right? Mm-hmm. And then you go and you see that clearance at the end of the aisle, the end cap clearance, right? And you know, you can read the little codes and it's 50, it's, you know, 30, 50, 70, you know, and you're saying to yourself, oh man, should I? How do you get the discipline to walk past that?
I mean, for me, it was even worse than that. Let's say you are the Lego seller and your target ROI is 70% and you see one that's 68%, right? It's just barely off in your category. And now my thing is I wrote it out. I said, here are my rules. If something doesn't hit these exact rules, I walk away.
And by no kidding. I mean, so you literally would walk away from 68%. You were that disciplined.
100%. It's
no kidding.
It's not – I'm not – like my rules, those rules are hard rules. It's because the second you get kind of flaky with them, where's the end point?
Right. It's rationalization. But how did you come up with those rules? Was it experience? I mean, did you look at the 80-20? I mean, what helped you make that decision for hard rules? Because that's different than guidelines, right? Hard rules are hard rules.
Yep. So when I was first starting out, right, I had $1,000, $2,000 a week to purchase inventory with. And I wanted to turn it as fast as possible. And so I needed a set of rules that would enable me to spend the, say, $2,000 a week. And what was going to be the best use of those funds. And so I set the rules as, back then it was nothing above $75,000 in rank and minimum of a, I think it was 100% ROI at the very beginning.
And was there a dollar amount too that you didn't want to make $2, right? Was there a certain dollar amount too?
No, because I was still shipping everything myself back then, so I didn't have any other real costs.
Okay.
But those were my rules, and generally because I was doing retail, I didn't really come across of items that cost me less than $5 to purchase.
Okay.
But because I could always hit that $2,000 mark within the kind of the also it was the number of hours, because back then I didn't have a car, so I had to rent a car to go do shopping and all that. And so I was spending 2 days a week shopping and the rest packing and shipping. And so I needed to be able to spend $1,000, and those rules enabled me to spend $1,000. And it also gave me a sales rate of, or a sell-through rate, roughly like 2 to 3 weeks.
No kidding.
Yeah. And so those were my metrics.
Do you think that's still possible?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I'm still doing it, just at a different scale.
Well, I know, but I mean, so the people who are struggling, because I had somebody reach out to me and they were like, because I always talk about getting stuck at 30,000, you know, and I think there's a limit, general limit, and I'm not saying it, you know, it's absolute. There are outliers, right, as Malcolm Gladwell will say. But I think 30,000 processing by yourself is doable. It's findable, not a big deal. But there are people that are saying they're at 10,000 and 12,000 and they can't get past that point. Do you think that this tip right here, the one that you're suggesting, if they would just figure out their absolutes and then stick with them and not get distracted, do you think that would help them get past that point?
Oh, 100%.
Still today?
Yeah. I mean, I think so many people are just turning their wheels on so many things that just aren't worth their time or their effort.
Looking back, is that what really propelled you? Really, I mean, is that the first real significant notch you went up?
Oh, yeah, without a doubt.
Okay, so you've really scaled that. Then you get into wholesale and you start scaling that. When was your first hire? When was your first employee that you hired?
My first employee was actually still retail.
Yeah. So you had sourcing, somebody doing, you know, you give them your credit card or whatever and say, hey, go buy this. Did you give them a list to buy, or did you give them a scanner and say scan?
No, even today, I have one employee who buys, but the other ones, it's all pack. And I hate packing. I don't think it's anybody's. Once you hit a very small number, let's say 10,000 a month in sales, you probably shouldn't be doing your own packing. And so my first employee was just helping me pack and ship boxes. And that was my first, like, 7-8 months in. I just couldn't pack stuff fast enough during the holiday season. And so I just hired somebody to help me pack and get stuff out so I can go back and buy more.
And this was, you were still in Chicago?
Yes.
So what caused the move back to L.A.?
That was more personal than anything. It was, okay. It was, I couldn't handle the cold anymore.
Oh yeah, and, man, I'm with you.
Yeah, it was tough. So I moved back. I didn't even have wholesale on the horizon when I moved.
Okay. And so you were still, were you able to just start back up your RA business as soon as you got to LA?
I mean, it really took me a month to get moved in, to get settled, and then to start the business up and running. But yeah, within a month I had my own car. I was going everywhere and sales were right back where they left off.
Well, that's interesting. So that means it's completely transferable. Once you have that skill set, you can pretty much do it anywhere.
Yeah. I mean, let's say if for whatever reason I wanted to leave the Amazon space, I'm fairly confident that within a year I can just still come back and make, you know, a decent living off of it and not worry about it.
Because you rode the bike, you learn how to, you know, to get up and take the training wheels off.
Yep.
Okay, so you go along and at this point, your father has a warehouse and he's scaling up his. Is he in wholesale at that point?
No. So actually the first warehouse, so I just moved back to LA. The first warehouse was a 50-50 split between me and my dad.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Wow.
So he took one wall. I took the other. We shared employees so that they can get their hours, even though neither of us had, you know, enough for everything. We were both doing RA. He was already slightly in wholesale. I was kind of just dipping my toes in, and we kind of got to there until it got so big that my dad was like, listen, I need my own space. You need to get out.
Oh, he kicked you out. What? But, you know, was it – how competitive was that, right? I mean, you're sitting there. Are you selling the same things? You going to the same stores?
I mean, it really wasn't competitive at all. It's okay. Even today, we get lunch once a week just to talk about the business and kind of
which I love, by the way. And I want to talk about that because I just think that is so cool that you still have lunch with them once a week to talk. That's so, you know, to see your dad in that way, as a dad, to have my son want to do that with me, that is a very, very cool thing. Let me tell you, someday you'll understand it when you have your own kids. That is a very, very cool thing, very respectful. But I bet you get just as much out of it as you give.
Oh, yeah. I mean, so we're very, very different types of entrepreneurs. My dad is very creative. He can look at a product and be like, okay, that's going to sell great. I'm much more process-oriented. And so, I mean, today buying for retail arbitrage gift cards is very common. When I started doing it, no one even knew what the gift card companies were. And so I was buying gift cards at like 25, 30, 35% off back in the day. And it took me weeks to get my dad to understand how valuable those gift cards were. But I had, you know, the process, I had the math behind it. And so eventually I was able to kind of convince him to come along.
Well, does it work the other way too? Are you able to run ideas past him and products past him saying, hey, I'm thinking about this or I'm this and that. And then he's able to give his sage advice?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's kind of what got me into wholesale because I was just focused on retail and that was all I was doing. And then all of a sudden I see him with the wholesale and the way that scaled and the way that improved his business. And it's like, okay, I can do that too. No, like 2 years ago, actually I beat him, which was great for me.
Okay.
And then last year he beat me by a little bit. It's like a 5 to 10% difference every year.
How about an average selling price?
So that's
wholesale average selling price lower than retail?
It just depends on what you're wholesaling. But that's another one where I've kind of taken the competitive advantage in. I'm going for typically $20 or below. And that's a lot of work to sell enough inventory to do our numbers at that price. Mm-hmm. And so because of that, it's another barrier to entry. Because if you're just by yourself or you have one or two employees, you just physically can't process the amount of units to compete with me in that space.
Hmm. And so your big competitive advantage is where you're located, right? You're in California. You're close to docks, you're close to shipping services, that kind of thing. That's a big competitive advantage, would you say?
Huge.
Is labor a competitive advantage for that market or versus other parts of the country, or is it challenging there too?
It depends. So cost-wise, labor here is significantly more expensive than the rest of the country. Minimum wage here starts at $10, and they just, you know, voted to increase it all the way up to $15 in the coming years. Mm-hmm. So it's that system's expensive. What I've done is I put my warehouse between a couple of universities. And so all of my employees are students, and it's just kind of a slightly higher caliber employee than you would just, you know, off of a blank Craigslist ad.
And so most of the referrals probably are word of mouth, right? So, you know, hey, I need somebody else. Do you know somebody? Oh, yeah, I know Jimmy Joe, who's in my English lit class or whatever, right? Is that how you get most of your employees?
No, because it's always random when I need them, and so it's not that they're always available. But my ads are very student-centric, and so I would say if I post an ad and I get 100 people responding, I would say at least 50 to 60 of them are students.
Huh.
And so I get – I just get to pick kind of the best out of that.
Right, and they're more qualified because they're, you know, they're educated, right, or they're in an education, so you're getting a little better caliber. And they know it's only short-term because that's what they need.
Well, yeah, but it's funny. Like I've had – I've never had, after the first, say, month or so, I've never had somebody quit. And so I've got employees that are with me for 2.5 years, which is basically as long as I've been in California. And my, like, youngest employer, I guess, the shortest tenure is at 8 months already.
So are you having trouble finding people, though?
No. I mean, anytime I need people, I just place the ad. And, I mean, at this point, I've got a system down where I'll post a Craigslist ad or whatever it is, and you get 100 respondents. I'll interview – I'll actually quadruple book interview time slots every 15 minutes, knowing that almost, you know, a third of them, just maybe a third out of everybody I book shows up. Out of that, you know, you hire 3 to 4, and out of those, 2 of them won't even show up for their first day. But the last 2 that remain are typically just awesome employees.
No kidding. But who does all the HR stuff? You do all that stuff?
Yeah. It's still all me. Most of the employees just do pack and ship.
Okay. So they're packing and shipping. You don't worry about theft?
I mean, it's always going to be an issue, and it's always a concern. At this point, for the most part, I trust my employees.
Okay.
Because if there's the fear side of business, and you can always wonder what if, but at some point you just have to kind of let it go and accept those risks.
Do you supervise all the staff too?
I mean, I have technically a hierarchy back there, but then at the end of the day, everyone reports to me.
Okay, but you do have some leadership that you don't have to go in and check every single thing. I mean, that's really the key.
No.
When did you hire your fifth employee? How big were your sales? Were you over 7 figures when you hired your fifth?
No, not even close.
Really?
Yeah, most of my employees are part-time also. So for me, having 5 employees is still not 5 full-time people.
Okay.
Go ahead.
No, I'm just trying to get to, you know, at what point do you scale? I mean, you took an employee on very early.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, very early in the model, right? Most people don't do it. They keep doing it by themselves. But that's probably why you've been so successful, is because you quickly replaced yourself in those lower responsibility positions, right? You just quickly said, I don't like doing this. Boom, put somebody in. I don't like doing this. Put somebody in. And so the fact that you've been able to do it, I'm trying to figure out when you've gotten to, you know, to that fifth, even part-time person, how big were your sales? Half a million?
Probably like 750.
Okay, so 750. So just trying to give people a frame of reference to think about, you know, where they're at, and then they can take a look inward. Because there are some people doing 750, and it's just a couple, right?
Yeah.
They're just doing it by themselves because that's what they like, and that's the responsibilities they want. I would argue that at some point that will get old. Right, it does get old. I mean, it becomes a job, and you don't want it to become a job. Would you say this has become a job for you?
In a lot of ways, yeah. I mean, I've also been doing it longer than I think most people that are in the Amazon space.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've kind of got my niche. I've got my aspects of it. And so there is – it's I have a, you know, a working space that's only for work. I leave the house and head to the office. So it's got that kind of feel to it. But there's still parts of it. Like I've got my own time freedom. It's a job, but it's the freedom of having a job that you kind of get to do what you want when you want. It's a job that I enjoy.
Well, yeah, you could go to Vegas and live the dream, and then come to Orlando and live out the dream a little bit further, and yet your business still operated while you were gone. Correct?
Yep, absolutely.
That's pretty cool. So you've now expanded, though, into other things. So you offer prep and ship services in California, which everybody's always asking me, hey, do you know anybody in California? And I'm always like, well, I kind of do, but I'm not really putting his name out there. But you do offer those services, right? And you do it for wholesale only. You're not interested in people dropping off OA or retail ARB or anything like that, correct?
Yeah. So we do wholesale and private label products. Okay. I'm still trying to figure out all the processes, so it's kind of still a work in progress. I haven't really advertised it anywhere, but we are kind of, it's a growing business.
You just did, though. Yeah. We know that. You just did.
Yeah, just launched it out to the entire internet, apparently.
Yeah, apparently. Well, but I know several customers of yours, and I was just with a few of them last weekend, and, I mean, you're like on this, they hold you up like you're the king. I mean, they got you up on a pedestal. Because they say you're just so reliable, so consistent, so reasonable. To me, that's hard to find.
I mean, I appreciate that. There's nothing really I can say. That's really humbling.
Yeah, it's really true though, and it wasn't just one. So as I said, that you fly below the radar. So would you take on another customer or two?
Yeah, I mean, I'd love to have a few more people to kind of keep growing, scaling, and seeing where we can take this, especially because. I'm sure some of my employees would love some more hours, so I don't think they would mind in the slightest.
Well, let's talk about your advantages. First off, you're in California, so you're by where a lot of inventory comes in. Do you have any knowledge of how much inventory comes in through the California docks?
Oh, I couldn't even begin to. It's monstrous, and most of the wholesalers have warehouses here or something in the area, so it's
like really close to you.
Yeah, it's huge volumes.
Right, so there's a big competitive advantage. I sell shoes, and a lot of my shoes come through California. I mean, it's one of the reasons that we were talking. And so that's a big advantage. You can handle pallet shipments.
Yep.
You ship by the pallet, right?
Yep.
That's scaled, not a problem. Any other competitive advantages you think you offer?
I mean, we can do the turnaround times. It's great. We have all the processes down. And shipping, it's going to be significantly cheaper to get it to our warehouse than if you're trying to get it across the country.
Right, and the shipping times, I think, is the most critical, especially around Q4. So when that stuff comes in the dock, it's to your warehouse very, very quickly. You can turn around and process. And a lot of my stuff, for some reason, always goes to those California warehouses.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's another big advantage, right? If you send a lot of material that happens to go to a California warehouse, you receive it in California, you process it, and you ship it to California. That's a big competitive advantage.
Huge, yeah. Like our stuff, when we ship freight, because actually most of my stuff ships freight at this point, I mean, I'm sending it at 7 cents a pound to the warehouse in California.
7 cents a pound?
Yeah. And that's probably 80 to 90% of my total inventory.
When I send something to California, it's 90 cents a pound. I'm not kidding. That's the truth. It's 90 cents a pound to ship stuff. And then whenever it comes up, I'm like, no.
Yep. It's a slight difference.
So looking back, right, you've come full circle, right? You grew up in this environment. You've been able to obviously absorb things. You went to school for it. You tried it, you fine-tuned it, you figured out you're where you want to be right now. Where do you see yourself going in the future? I mean, it must be – you must have those thoughts about, maybe I'd like to do this, or what are you thinking?
Yeah, I mean, I've always got side projects. I really like kind of this space and what's going on here. But I'm a naturally very curious person, and there is the constant pull of, well, I could be doing something else, you know? And so I don't know that I'm actually going to do anything else. My one thing is I'm constantly trying to narrow my focus. Even as I'm saying that I'm launching, a prep and ship company. So I can't
right.
say that I'm too effective at it, but I think there's immense value in staying within your sphere until you really master it and then moving on.
Okay. And clearly you have done that. What do you think is your biggest strength? Is that it, that you're able to focus probably more attentive? You definitely got the discipline. If you can hold yourself to not buying a 68,000, when it, or 68% ROI when it's you said 70 was your hard number. That's a discipline. Is that your biggest strength, do you think?
I mean, it's hard to say what's the biggest one. There's different aspects of the business, right? So one of the biggest ones for me is operationally, I'm significantly better than most Amazon sellers in my unhumble opinion.
Like process.
Yeah. I mean, if you think about how many times something gets touched, how long it takes to get it out the door,
how fast and how we can make it as cheap as possible. I've been consistently able to figure out how to handle products that other people don't want to deal with, right? And so that's been a huge advantage for me. So there's that. There's developing relationships with suppliers so that I can get it at prices that other people can't get inventory. And then, yeah, there's the discipline of saying I'm not – one of the things I've run across is – so my suppliers at this point, some of them have had, I don't know, 100 Amazon sellers reach out to them at this point.
Right, right.
And they don't want to deal with them because there's the – some of the attitude issues and some of the things that people kind of discuss and how they discuss the Amazon space. And for me, it's always been a, look, I'm doing great volume by Amazon standards, but by wholesale, retail – business standards, it's small. And so kind of walking them through my process, showing them how I'm doing it, it's giving me a huge edge in that they just want to, you know, sell to me and deal with me and then make my life easier so that I can make theirs easier.
Less hassle. So are you suggesting that some Amazon sellers are, you know, exaggerating their abilities or exaggerating their model, like, hey, I'm a big deal in this business, when really, as you're saying, in the wholesale world, you're not a speck?
Yeah, I mean, I was talking to one of my guys recently, and he sells to Sears, right? And he was talking about an Amazon seller that was coming in and bragging about how he's going to buy 10 of every item the guy sells, which is like a $5,000 to $10,000 order, which in Amazon's world, for one supplier, that's you know, a significant amount of money. But he was also talking about how he does a deal with Sears, where for one item, it's a $200,000 order. And so it just doesn't compare.
Right. It's a spec. And it's a nuisance, you know, selling, you know, all those, you know, 10 of each item means that every one of those could be a problem, where one $200,000 order, it's one item. If there's a problem, it's one problem. It's not, you know, 50 other items. Right. So that's interesting. What do you think your weakness is then? Right. So you got some strengths, but where do you struggle?
For me, the struggle is definitely in picking inventory that's not analytically based. Like I'm at kind of my own variation of a ceiling of I now need to find either new categories or new suppliers or new something to grow, and it might be bundling, it might be private label, if I want to get to that next level. And I don't have that natural touch of some sellers just can say, hey, these two items in a bundle are going to go great. I don't
like
have
your
that.
Dad.
Yeah, exactly.
Like your dad, right? I mean, that's his skill set. Are you more like your mom then? The process with the daycare, I mean, that's a process, right? That's all regimented. That's consistently, you know, I mean, they got to do this, they got to do that, they got to take their nap, they got to eat this time, right? That's a lot of process.
It is, but I would say she's much more of a people person, the touch feel of things than I am. I'm not quite sure how I became so analytically oriented. But it was definitely, it's something I've always just been, I will look at a process and think, okay, I spent 8 hours on it. How can I cut that in half?
Right. Right. And that fine tuning is again, how you got your competitive advantage. No question in my mind. So give me a personal success or a personal habit that brings you success. Something that you do every day that just boom has brought you a lot of success. I mean, are you getting up at the same time? Are you getting up an hour earlier than everybody else? Are you going to the gym first? Are you eating the right meal? Are you staying late? What do you do that's kind of become a habit that you would say is a reason that you've had some real good success?
I mean, I do all that stuff, right? I try to eat very healthy. Physically, for me, I've gotten to the point where I really deteriorated my health physically. And I made good money there, but I hated my life at that point. It was miserable. And you're working insane hours and just didn't help. So for me, it was a whole lifestyle shift of I started eating very healthy. I work out 4 or 5 times a week. I make sure I get my 8 hours of sleep, and it's amazing what it's done both to my caliber of thinking and just general happiness level with everything in my life.
I love it. I think that's so smart, and I think that's, again, that discipline, right? You're back to that discipline. It's easy to get away from it when you go to Vegas and then to Orlando and,
yeah,
and drink that much. It does. See what happens to your voice? That's your body saying, hey.
Yeah.
How about tools that you're using that you think that others could benefit from? Anything that outside of the ordinary that you think that somebody could say that you're surprised people aren't using? Internet tools or anything?
One thing that's really helped me out, and it's a bit unusual, is I was very early on, I hired a developer to just build me custom tools. And because the thing is if you're using the same stuff that everybody else is using, you don't have a competitive edge there.
Right. No edge.
And at this point, everyone knows what's out there. It's not like scan power is a hidden gem. And so I had a developer build me custom tools to help me go through my supplier's inventory faster and more effectively, and to help my employees work faster, which is one of the biggest advantages I have. I spent $1,000 on custom software that cut my employee times by, I don't know, 80%. And so if you're coming in with, you know, the typical set of, you know, tools when you hire employees, you're just not going to be as effective as I am.
Well, give me an example. So something that, you know, that's not secret that you could say, show me how it saved you time.
Sure. So once we upload the inventory to Amazon, most people today are either going through ScanPower or Inventory Lab and printing out, you know, the labels and then sorting it and figuring out where it should go and all that stuff. Or they're printing out sheets, right, and then doing one by one. I had software developed where my employees could go, and after everything was uploaded to Amazon, scan the UPC. It would tell them how many units were going, which locations were receiving which quantities, and let them print the labels on the spot. And so then if I have the UPCs just as I'm uploading it on my computer from my supplier invoices, my employees don't even have to look at anything. They could just go in, take a pallet apart, and just process it in an hour, as opposed to having to go one by one and figuring out what items which. And it reduces mistakes because it's going right off UPC.
So the current process for most people would be they'd open the pallet, they'd see, you know, maybe they'd separate it down by product type. Then they would hit scan and they'd say, oh, I got 68 of those. They'd hit it into ScanPower or Inventory Lab. It would start printing out labels, right? They'd label it, and then they'd start saying, okay, these 6 go over to that box. These 12 go over here. These, right? And so how many times have they touched that product?
Yep.
You're saying that you have developed software when – so your PO comes in or your invoice comes in. You upload it to your third-party site, and it says, okay, there are 68 of these. Don't take the pallet apart. As you're taking the pallet apart, 6 of these go over here, 12 of these go over here, right? So there's no extra scanning, no extra touching, and it's just done at that point, right?
Yeah, my employees take an item, scan it, label it, put it in a box, put the box on the pallet, and they're done. So we touch an item once.
And you've been doing that for a while.
Yeah, I had that developed 3 years ago.
So now think about that, everybody who's listening, and they're thinking, hey, you know, we're all seeing millions of scrapers come out, right? Millions of new little things coming out. 3 years ago, a mega seller, who's a mega seller for a reason, already had that developed that long ago. So when this pallet or shipped by the box content information comes, no big deal to you because you pretty much already have that figured out.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
I love it. Okay, dude. Telling you, amazing stuff. You know, if somebody's interested in finding out about how to do use you as a prep and ship company, how do they do that?
Email me is the best way.
What's the email?
It's obenzvy, B-E-N-Z-V-Y, at Gmail. We're still pretty small on scale, but just send an email there. Let me know kind of what your volumes are, what you're looking for, and I can shoot you all the details after that.
That's awesome. All right, so you know the goal of this podcast is to get that person unstuck, and I think you've given us about 85 things that they could do to get unstuck. But I want one more, something somebody can come out and put into their business tomorrow that would help them get past that point of stuck. I'm telling you, you gave me a ton already.
Yeah, honestly, one of the best things I can do is I would say sit down and write out how – if you – let's say you're already at 10,000 at least, right? You've got a bit of a model kind of taking shape. Sit down, see what's working the best for you, and figure out why is that a competitive advantage? How can you kind of grow that advantage, and how can you scale that little bit of a model? I think taking the time, sitting down and writing it, which is one of the things that people don't really do, but writing out your ideas and making it crystal clear, and then go out and test it for a month or two. And really stay disciplined to that. I think that's a huge benefit that very few sellers actually try.
I love it. All right. Hey, man, I can't wait to see you again. I wish you nothing but success. I appreciate you taking the time. I know you're a busy guy. But, man, I really appreciate what you're doing, and I love the fact that you're open to taking on new clients. I just think that it's such a great competitive advantage to be in California, and you're one of the few, one of the very few that offer that service. So best wishes. I'll see you at the next conference, and
Maybe I'll make it to CrossFit anyway. I don't know, man. No promises.
I'm not sure I can make it care. Again. Thank you. It's been a blast chatting again.
Take care.
Man, I hope you enjoyed this one as much as I did. I got to spend time with Orr in Florida, and I mean, just it was just such a great time. I hope you enjoy these series. Lots of changes coming up. I have a new website that's in the works. Hopefully within the next 2 weeks it'll be out, and it's got a ton of extra things that I can do, including some of the recent talks I've given. I've recorded them and even have some video, so I'll put them up on the website. And then episode 100 is coming, and it's coming so fast, I can't believe it. And it's a special one for me. It's a special one, I think, for everyone, and I'm really excited about it. So another great episode coming up right after this one. Keep listening, ecommercemomentum.com. Take care.
Thanks for listening to the E-Commerce Momentum Podcast. All the links mentioned today can be found at ecommercemomentum.com under this episode number. Please remember to subscribe and like us on iTunes.